Welcome to Gospel Tangents. I'm Dan Vogel.
Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. We're continuing our conversation with historian Dan Vogel about the multiple first vision accounts. Are those differences a big deal or not at all? So we're going to talk about those different perspectives and how those should or should not be reconciled. Check out our conversation.
Both Mormon and Joseph Smith were instructed to go to a hill and remove the record, and then Mormon was to engrave on it. Joseph Smith was to translate it. Mormon was about 24 years of age, which corresponds to 1830 when Joseph Smith published the Book of Mormon. So what does it mean for when it says Mormon at age 15... being so of a sober mind? That's Joseph Smith's view of himself too. Therefore, I was visited. What is it? What is visited of the Lord, and tasted and knew the goodness of Jesus? What is that? So, there's many other scriptures I could bring to bear on this. Like Hebrews talks about, uses that term tasted. Those who have fallen away had once tasted and fallen away, cannot be renewed again. But Alma says it. In Alma 36, Alma 36 is when he's converted, the story of his conversion from being a damned soul to being tasting of the goodness of Jesus in a way. He says, many have been born of God and have tasted, and as I have tasted. So what is it? What is it? And Alma talks about the Spirit coming upon him, you know, and that he basically has a born-again experience. So I believe this is an example of an autobiographical part of the Book of Mormon, and that this is probably the core, the kernel of Joseph Smith's first vision, or 1820-21 encounter with deity that evolves when he uses this to become an apostle, to justify himself, calling himself in all regard an apostle, and that the story evolves just like he did his revelations. Okay. So that I think that pretty well says it for the first vision.
Okay, so in summary, we've got an 1832 account, 1835 account, 1838. Those are the three main versions.
Those are the ones that are probably the most important. The ones that come after that.
The other six are just derivatives.
It would be Orson Pratt, Remarkable Visions. Basically, a few details different. The Wentworth letter, John Wentworth, the editor of the New York newspaper. It's basically from Orson Pratt. Orson Hyde in a German publication, you have to translate it, which Dean Jesse was one of the first to publish a translation of it. Then there's one of the ones is German dentist guy in Nauvoo, blanking on his Niebuhr. Hmm. Niebuhr, whatever. He adds a few details that are quite kind of interesting, where Joseph Smith says in the revival he couldn't sing or shout with the others, which is an important key. Also, on the revival itself, which I forgot, so Wesley Walters came out in the late 60s, and was saying that he could find no evidence of a revival, which got everybody focused on trying to prove, Joseph Smith could have seen great multitudes uniting, converts uniting to the churches in faraway places. It's 15 to 15 miles away. Milton Backman, made a map with this circle on it showing where revivals were taking place around Joseph Smith's region. And it all came down to the meaning of words. There was in the place where we lived an unusual excitement on the subject of religion. It commenced with the Methodists, but soon became general among all the sects in that region of country. Indeed, the whole district of country seemed affected by it, and great multitudes united themselves to the different religious parties, which created no small stir and division amongst the people, priest contending against priest and convert against convert, so that all their good feelings one for another, if they ever had any, were entirely lost in a strife of words and a contest about opinions. So, Mormon apologists, Milton Bachman, Stephen Harper, some others, would focus on, so the region of country, that it commenced with the Methodists, but soon became general among all the sects in the region of country. Indeed, the whole district of country seemed affected by it, and great multitudes united themselves to the different religious parties. The great multitudes, converts, and this is what Wesley Walters tried to document, where, because they would advertise in the newspaper, so many people converted at this revival, that revival, you know, because they were bragging in the Methodist magazine and Presbyterian publications. And he couldn't find these great multitudes until 1824-25 in Palmyra. So the apologists tried to focus on, well, it doesn't say multitudes were converted in Palmyra. It says, you know, it talks about whole district of country, region of country, then great multitudes. So there's an ambiguity in the description. The problem is that the next, it goes on, the next paragraph, I was at this time in my 15th year, which is 1820. So he's saying the multitudes happened in 1820. So they go in the region of country to look for them. And that, and then my father's family were proselyted to Presbyterian faith. So we know Lucy was converted in 1824-25. So once you admit, this is what Quinn does. This is, the first one to do it was Marvin Hill in a paper in the Mormon History Association, gave a paper, and he admitted that Lucy did join in an 1824-25 revival with Reverend Lane as the minister there. Reverend, we know all these converts happened because Reverend Lane wrote about it in the Methodist magazine, you know, in January of 1825. He's talking about all these conversions in Palmyra. So they admit that part of the passage is anachronistic, that Joseph Smith has moved this part, this element of his mother's conversion and the three siblings to 1820 without notifying the reader that he jumped to this other revival.
Couldn't that just be explained away as a mistaken memory, though? You know, I mean,
4 years, four or five years.
David Whitmer messed up on, where was it, Manchester? Was it
Fed? That's 1 year.
I mean, isn't that... Couldn't he just... I mean, he's doing this in 1838. He just conflated the events. I mean, isn't that a reasonable explanation?
Did he? Okay, so once you admit that he has a faulty memory on this in regard to Lucy's conversion, then why struggle to make the revival happen in Palmyra, or that Joseph Smith could have attended a revival somewhere in the region? Why struggle with that when you've already admitted that this part over here with Lucy could be a faulty memory, that no matter how it happened, it's anachronistic to this account? So you've already admitted that there's anachronisms.
Okay.
So why be so hard-nosed about the revival unless you have some vendetta against Wesley Walters?
Well, that's kind of my question, because to me, and maybe it's just me, I don't care really whether it was 1820 or 1824, Joseph got the date wrong. I mean, what's the big deal, I guess, is what I'm
saying. Okay, well, I don't think it's a big deal.
Okay.
But, and so even Quinn admits, let's say Quinn admits that Joseph Smith brought it back and put it in 1820. I think there's a reason why Joseph Smith did this, though.
In 1820?
Yeah, why he moved this revival to here.
Okay, why?
Because he made the vision answer the question that happened in 1824. So once he...
Okay.
Remember in 1832, he's only forgiven of his sins. Okay. He's not told, don't join any of the churches. Right?
Right.
Don't join any of the churches. Because we know that that he attends the Methodist Church. He doesn't join, but he attends the Methodist Church in Harmony, Pennsylvania with Emma, his wife. But there's no commandment not to join any of the churches. They're all false. But it isn't until 1838, don't join. Because he's made this vision, he's changed this vision from a personal experience into one that's a founding event for the church. So he's using the revival to teach a lesson. Okay, and there's several lessons in the 1838 account. And one of them is, he's using the vision and the command not to join any of these churches, he's moving it back to this 1820 time when the question of which church is true didn't come up until 1824-25. 1820, he's in harmony with his parents. All churches are wrong. Lucy, in 1824... or 25, we don't know which, joins the Presbyterian Church, divides the family. Lucy's pressuring him
to join
with the rest of the other three children. Join. And Joe Smith says, I can go out in the woods and read my Bible and learn more than I could in the year of going to church. And in the 1838 account, he adds, in December 1842, this didn't get published the first time in the Times and Seasons because it wasn't until December. He added two little things with Willard Richards as his scribe, saying he came home from the vision and leaned up against the mantelpiece and told his mother that he's learned that Presbyterianism isn't true. Now, that doesn't fit 1820. She hasn't joined the Presbyterian Church. She's not pressuring anybody yet. So how is it that he can lean up against the fireplace and say, the vision has answered that? That's because he's changed this vision from a personal experience about salvation and forgiveness of sins into a foundational event for his church.
Let me ask another question then. And I don't know that anybody's ever advocated this. This is just me kind of spitballing here. But could it be possible that and you do believe he had some sort of a... Maybe, let's say he had this born-again experience in 1820, 21. Could he have had another vision in 1824 that said, don't join any churches? Is he conflating perhaps two visions rather than just one?
Yeah, if you dated the first vision to 1824, we have no problem.
Okay.
But he never claimed that. Another thing that should be mentioned is that he's, the 1838 account, he's dictating in Missouri. And in Missouri, he's being persecuted and about to go to jail, actually, for 6 months. Go to prison for 6 months. So he's enduring quite a lot of persecution. He's about to enter into, he's trying to get the Holy Land of Jackson County back.
Mm-hmm.
Actually,
because they've been kicked out in 1833,
yeah,
right?
He's, in a way, he's trying to appeal to the Missourians to, you know, leave him alone. In various ways, he does. He has a campaign. He does try. He is still trying to get Zion back. But he said, I soon found, however, that my telling the story had excited a great deal of prejudice against me among professors of religion, and was the cause of great persecution, which continued to increase. And though I was an obscure boy, only between 14 and 15 years of age, and my circumstances in life such to make a boy of no consequence in the world. Yet men of high standing would take notice sufficient to excite the public mind against me and create a bitter persecution. And this was common among all the sects, all united to persecute me. Now, this is pure fiction for 1820. But absolutely true in Missouri. Right? This is exactly what he's experiencing right then when he's dictating this. And his followers, and some of his followers, remember, he's just excommunicated all the leaders, David Whitmer, Oliver Cowdery, John Whitmer, all these W.W. Phelps, even. He's excommunicated them. They've turned against him. And all the religious leaders around are persecuting him and his followers. And he's trying to tell the story so his followers identify with his account. You know.
So this is an 1835?
No, this is 1838 account.
Oh.
This is after he's had the vision that he keeps on going. This is a part that people don't read all that closely, I guess. But he keeps on going with the 1838. He's just saw Jesus. And Jesus has just told him not to join any of the churches, that their creeds are an abomination in his sight. Well, the harsh language in the vision is an attack on his persecutors in Missouri.
Okay, so are you saying that, because I know that he's complaining in the 1838 account that he told a minister about it and he's being persecuted. Are you saying that didn't happen? Is that what you're saying? That he's really just recreating a completely new thing to parallel what's happening in Missouri in 1838? Is that what you're saying?
Well, so, yeah, I did leave out the part where he talks about he was in the company of one of the participants in this revival, and they condemned his vision.
Right.
But if you read it really carefully, it doesn't sound like he told him about the first vision. I mean, Joseph Smith was participating probably in this 1824-25 revival where he couldn't sing and shout with the rest of the family members. And they probably rejected him if he tried to talk about the treasure guardian and the gold plates and possible information on the gold plates that might have solved some religious issues, you know. And he doesn't identify the participant, one of the leaders in this meeting. But the response was, well, God doesn't give revelations anymore. You know, the Bible's all there is, basically. Which would be a response to the gold plates, not to God appearing. Because we just talked about how Methodists and other revivalists and even ministers, when they have their conversion experiences, talk about similar visions. And the 1832 account, which is after that, supposedly, doesn't talk about, you know, it says all the churches are false and that they, you know, traditions of men and God, Jesus is going to come and destroy the ungodly and the wicked soon. But it doesn't talk about anything a revivalist would have a problem with, really. So I think the story, even though he's talking about rejecting his vision, this minister, this person, which could be anybody, not really a minister, because it could be a lay minister like Willard Richards, because Willard Richards in the 1830 census, I believe it is, says that he's a Methodist clergy, or, you know, a minister. So he could have been a lay Methodist minister. But they're rejecting his, probably the story of the guardian angel or guardian spirit, treasure guardian over the plates, telling that story and that the plates started having a religious connotation. And they rejected that because there's no more revelations. The Bible is all there is. So forget about that story of your book. you know, and I don't care what answers are in that book, you know, because the Bible's, that's all there is. That's the only revelation. They wouldn't have condemned the first vision. There was nothing to condemn in it.
Okay.
So one more part here is how he's using this story with his present audience. As proof of his mission. It seemed as though the adversary was aware at a very early period of my life that I was destined to prove a disturber and an annoyer of his kingdom. Else why should the powers of darkness combine against me? Why the opposition and persecution that arose against me almost in my infancy? Well, this is pure fiction when you talk about it from the standpoint of 1820. But something he wants, a message he wants to tell his followers. The more they persecute me, the more, that's because I'm telling the truth. It's the devil, they're of the devil and they're trying to persecute me. Then he goes on to say, I have actually seen a vision, and who am I that I can withstand God, or why does the world think to make me deny what I've actually seen? For I have seen a vision, I knew it, and I knew God knew it, and I could not deny it. Neither dare I do it. At least I knew that by so doing, I would offend God and come under condemnation. That's the apostates. That's the people that did deny the Mormonism and have left him. And he's telling them, don't deny the faith. Stay. Don't come under God's condemnation and deny and leave me.
So let me ask you this question, because I remember Richard Bushman in an interview several years ago said one of the things that he struggled with was he couldn't understand why, for some people, when you look at the first vision narratives, it was so, oh, look at all these conflicts. Oh. This proves Mormonism isn't true. But for other people, and I guess this is where I would probably fit in, are these don't really matter. Like, I can see Joseph, you know, maybe he did. Well, and I also know that Richard Bushman, I believe in his book, Rough Stone Rolling, said something to the effect of, Joseph didn't always tell everything, that he kept a lot of things to himself for times. And he would tell a piece to this audience, say in 1832, and then he would tell another piece in 1838, that the vision may relate to their current circumstances, this persecution that you're talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, and so for some people, these first vision conflicts are a big deal and they prove Mormonism isn't true. And for other people, it's like, what's the big deal? Why is this an issue? So I guess my question is, where do you fit in there? I mean, in my mind, would it be inconsistent, you know, and I'm a believer, to say, well, maybe he had something in 1820 or 1821. Maybe it was a born-again experience. Maybe he didn't tell everything in that 1832 account. And then when 1838, he's having these persecutions, maybe he's misremembering some things and going to 1824. It's not a testimony killer. I'll put it that way. So, number one, where do you fit among those two groups?
Okay, so my goal is not to kill people's testimony. Okay, I'm just a historian. And this is how to look at the documents in a historically minded way.
Okay.
Historians look for these kinds of things to show development. So some of the details you could write off as memory problems, but you can't use faulty memory like Stephen Harper does as an apologetic to explain away contradictions. You might use faulty memory, like there's false memory syndrome, where you can actually show, people can actually create false memories, trying to remember vague memories. And it works. I mean, an example would be the Spalding witnesses. They have vague memories about a manuscript in the past. Well, we know that what they remembered was wrong. I mean, because they could only remember what they had read in the Book of Mormon and nothing else. And we know that the Book of Mormon is not about the lost 10 tribes. That was a common misconception, but these witnesses, that's got into their memory somehow. And it's a vague story. They vaguely remember the names. The memories become sharper the more they talk to each other. So we know from other methods that they were wrong, okay? But we don't use false memory syndrome to prove that they're wrong. We use that as an explanation of how they got it wrong, okay? So you can't come up on Joseph Smith and say, well, there's these contradictions, and they could all be explained away by this false memory syndrome theory. Or else you can never catch anyone making things up or prevaricating on whatever issue. They could always say it's memory, and a lot of politicians try that. But it's not what historians do. It's what apologists do.
Okay,
so I wouldn't say, I'm not trying to kill people's memory or testimonies. That's not in my concern. I don't care about that question. Okay, it's not that I don't care about your religion or anything. I don't care about destroying people's faith or anything. I'm just trying to get the close to what probably really happened as I can. That doesn't mean that some people of faith can hang on to that faith, but it has to maybe evolve a little bit. You know, I'm just trying to find the facts and what probably the best evidence, the best scenario to explain the evidence. It's not my job to figure out how people of faith are to what to do with this. I could just point out the problem, not the answer, maybe. You know, so I think there is a way. There is a way to hang on as long as you want, but
so you wouldn't be
and people in different ways. It's a very personal thing.
So you wouldn't be opposed to somebody that says, "Yeah, I think Joseph conflated maybe one or two visions here, conflated 1820 with 1824, and it's not that big of a deal." Yeah, there's some contradictions there, but it's a faulty memory. Big deal.
Well, I think he changed it on purpose to teach a lesson. He's more concerned. He's a charismatic leader. Mm-hmm. He's not a historian. He can care less about history, facts, keeping the revelations pure as they were originally given. He doesn't care about any of that. He is trying to get things done, motivate people to do things that they wouldn't do without this motivation. And
So your opinion, which may be different than a faithful person's opinion.
Yeah. It is.
Okay, so you think he had a born-again experience, 1821, mm-hmm. and then he embellished this first visionist mm-hmm. story as time went on in order to prove some, say, spiritual truths or authority claims or things like that. That's kind of where you're coming from?
Yeah, it's useful fiction, as you might call it, but it really happened. It really changed his life. The original born-again experience was real to him, in my mind. Real. It changed his life. It made him do things that... I see Joe Smith as a religious zealot, not some atheist guy that is out to con people, get money, and manipulate people. And I believe he is a narcissist, like just about any leader in any area of life, almost. I believe he does have, I wouldn't say he has narcissistic personality disorder, though. I don't think it's necessary to diagnose him with a disorder. I'm just saying he has narcissistic traits.
Okay.
And which charismatic leaders do. Mm-hmm. And it's part of what drew people to him. And what made him not doubt himself and think that he had limitations. I mean, that whole idea of he's going to found a Zion, you know, in the wilderness, and it's going to become a large city and take over the world, is a pretty narcissistic endeavor. So he wouldn't have tried such a thing, and he failed, of course, miserably failed with the establishing Zion, because narcissists overestimate their abilities, and he did. So he has those traits. I kind of lost my train.
All right. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with historian Dan Vogel. In our next conversation, we're going to talk about the Book of Abraham. What was found on the scrolls with those Egyptian mummies in Kirtland?
One Horus scroll, Book of Breathings. He has one on the oldest female. There's a scroll, Ta Sheret Min, Book of the Dead, which is what we identify later as the record of ancient Joseph, which is the one that has all the nice little pictures and stuff and drawings of things that Oliver Cowdery describes, like the Pillar of Enoch and, you know, three in one God and stuff like that.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please support Gospel Tangents and become a subscriber. For just $5 a month, go to patreon.com/gospeltangents and you can hear the entire interview. And you can also get transcripts available in either our Amazon website, or if you want to give the money to me and not Amazon, please subscribe on my website at gospeltangents.com and you can click the yellow subscribe button. Of course, we're also on Facebook, Twitter, and all the other places. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. And don't forget to click here to subscribe on YouTube, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again for listening.